And for the San Diego Political Podcast on bowlersdesk.com, it's Matt Bowler. I kind of have a cold. Met up with Rick Epps at the Kensington Park next to the Kensington Library over there near the Kensington sign, near the Kensington Cinema, over next to the Kensington Grill. And yep, we were in Kensington. It was nice. Kind of hung out there. His kids played catch. And we talked about stuff that we like to talk about, which is politics and what's going on politically. Talked about Carl DeMaio announcing his official run for Congress, becoming the Republican, or at least hoping that he becomes the Republican candidate against Scott Peters, the Democratic incumbent congressman. Scott's been in office all of, 5 months, and now he's supposed to start campaigning again. Wow. And we talked about Turkey. A lot of uprisings happening there. Turkey, the elbow of the Middle East, you know, where Europe meets Asia and the Middle East. It's just this big multicultural, multi-ethnic melting pot that has always been incredibly complicated. And, you know, their political situation, how that's going to impact Syria, how Syria is impacting Russia, how Russia is impacting China and the United States, and of course that comes back to us here in San Diego. And of course, like I say, every week, if you've got anything you want to add, disagree with anything, want to comment or question, give us a call, 619-663-4531, 619-663-4531. And we may play your comments or questions in our podcast. So, political podcast from bowlersdesk.com. We're over here at Kensington Park talking politics again with Rick Epps, San Diego's political professor, and me, Matt Bowler from bowlersdesk.com.
Good to see you, buddy.
Nice to see you, too.
Good to see you again.
Hanging out at Kensington Park this time.
On a chilly Sunday, after a beautiful few days, and all of a sudden today...
I'm going to complain about it only being 68 degrees in San Diego.
I know.
And our friends... your friends in Oxford are gonna really hate you for that. I mean, you're complaining, but you're in shorts and flip-flops.
Exactly. Yeah. But I got a long sleeve.
And a long sleeve. That's your winter coat. That's a long sleeve shirt, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It buttons down in the front, so in case it gets warm.
So, yeah, it could be worse. It could be a lot worse. But it's chilly. It's supposed to be warm this time of year, but the weather's been weird.
After a few days of 90-degree weather, then we go back to this.
All of a sudden,
We're still pretty fortunate overall, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, so, this week was crazy. Locally, we had Scott Peters, is Democratic congressman, been in office 4 or 5 months.
Yep.
And Carl DeMaio, the libertarian gay Republican, announced his candidacy against Scott Peters, the traditional kind of centrist Democrat.
Yeah.
And it was funny to watch DeMaio on Fox 5 Morning News talking about wanting to reach out over the aisle and trying to attack Scott Peters on his record, but he's only been in office for 4 months. So it's not like you really even have a record at that point.
Exactly.
I mean, how can you have a record? Maybe in a year he'll have a record to, and you can go after him on it, but it seems a little early to be even saying, oh, I'm going to go after him on his record. He hasn't done anything yet.
Yeah, it starts the political follies of setting up the negative imagery for Scott Peters. But again, I agree with you. It's a little too early in the game to get there and to try and make those assertions. You know, but again, he's trying to set himself up, you know, to create that imagery for the public. So
yeah, and I wonder what he's really going to be able to accomplish within today's Republican Party. I mean, he can't come off and say, oh, I'm an outsider, because he's not an outsider. DeMaio is definitely a product of the Washington machine. You know, he always was.
Yeah.
Right?
Again,
I mean, that's where he started his career, was in D.C.
Yeah. But he's a part of it. But then again, the question for him is going to be the struggle is, is he going to be able to gain the kind of traction from the national GOP because of his sexual orientation. I mean, that's because, let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
The truth is,
yeah.
which is nothing wrong with it, by the way. But the sad part is that there's, you know, there is a, you know,
within the
action
the,
within the GOP.
Oh my God! Yeah, I'm trying to actually pull up his little soundbite. How's he going to be effective on a national scale with people that are blatantly anti-gay?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, paranoid. Some of them, like, gays are the problems that are the cause of all of the problems on the planet.
Especially those delusional. With strong religion, with religious overtones. I mean, it becomes a real issue. And, I mean, people don't like to talk about it, but we're not afraid to talk about it here. But it is one of those things that he's going to have to confront. I mean, even in running for mayor in San Diego, I think he was able to get money from the GOP because of his basically to keep quiet about.
Yeah, he would disagree on that. And I remember, you know, they all say, well, that's not why the Republicans gave me money. But he wouldn't take a position on gay marriage, though.
No.
And he was the only one of the candidates that wouldn't take a position, whereas everyone else, all of the other candidates did.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that does speak to it. I mean, especially if, you know, Nathan Fletcher was definitely thought to be a lock for the Republican nomination, if not the win.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So this really this will be interesting to see how he situates himself and what kind of a stance he can really come up with strongly, you know, on this. So here's an interesting note, though. The interesting part of this could be, as the Republican Party tries to redefine itself a little bit in terms of, you know, being, you know, pro, a little bit more positive toward immigration. I mean, not say pro-immigration, but stepping up toward being more, giving immigrants more recognition. The other thing is, would this also be a thing they'd be looking at doing with regarding to gays? And if so, then certainly that could be a powerful platform for him to potentially stand on.
But will this be, couldn't this be really just a really good opportunity for the Republican Party to show what a big tent they have?
Well, absolutely, it could. That's why I'm saying I think it'd be great if that's the risk he. I mean, it's a risk. Let's take it. I mean, let's put it out there. I mean, if he goes there, there are some who are not going to like that because there are some in the Republican Party, which is again still very factionalized in Washington, who recognize there are those who recognize that there is a necessary change that needs to take place. Hopefully, one that's a real, true change, not one that's just for lip service that gives people the sense that they really do care about, you know, immigrants and care about, you know, people of color and care about gay lesbians and things like that and those who are economically, you know, disadvantaged. But if they can get there and they really mean it in a real way, then this could be a turning point for the Republican Party.
So could San Diego, because I mean, San Diego has been always this kind of this low key Republican city, but but really important on a national scale.
Yeah.
Reagan loved San Diego. You know, Pete Wilson was a major started in San Diego.
Absolutely.
You know,
he was mayor. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, could this kind of foreshadow a little shift that, you know, Republicans want to make, right? Because there's so much more money if you're a bigger tent, if you're more of a libertarian style, more of an international conservative.
Well, let's face it, there are certain areas of the country where a neo-Republican or neo-GOP person could really thrive. And Southern California in general is one of those places. Just like the Northeast could also be a haven for those types of individuals who are sort of socially aware and conscious, but also really understand the nuances of the changes that need to be made and are willing to step in those directions versus some other areas of the country where it's not quite so popular to make those changes, and or that change is much slower to come. So again, this the question is: can the GOP get past its own factionalism on these issues? Because it's going to be a big issue going into the next presidential race, and even in November.
Chris Christie is who they're talking about now, and how does he even jive with those kind of traditional red state Republicans?
Yeah, and I mean, he doesn't.
He's a what do they call him? A Roosevelt Republican.
Yeah.
You know, he works well with Democrats because he has to. He works well with unions because he has to. So how are they going to be able to find someone like that and make him applicable, or even like DeMaio, and make them work in those traditional red states and change that mentality and that culture?
Yeah, and I think that's really, and again, this is going to be, for those who are interested in politics, this is going to be really an interesting thing for you to watch going into the November primaries, and then also moving forward into the next presidential race, is because this is going to determine that you'll see play out the factionalism, mm-hmm. and whether the neo-Republicans can stand against the traditional Republicans and how that actually plays itself
and
out.
And what a neo-Republican or a neo-conservative in America means now.
Exactly.
You know, and if they can get past all of their social issues, then what does that mean economically?
Exactly.
And what does that mean now? I mean, that's the big question. So yeah. It's interesting to see.
Well,
you know?
Plus you think about it, in terms of the moderate vote, the undecided voters, this is the way you can catch a lot of the middle ground. If you can really show that that you're interested with those groups of people, this is where you can make some good steps forward, and we'll mm-hmm. see if they're able to do it.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting.
Here's some to see if this works. Scott Peters responding to DeMaio announcing he's running.
So here's the thing. It's kind of funny. I've been in office for not even 5 months. You can't get on the ballot till next March. And people are talking about running. I don't know whether Mr. DeMaio will choose to do it or not, but I'm really interested in doing the job. And I think, you know, at some time next year, I will talk to voters about whether my approach of trying to be a problem solver and not be so partisan is the right approach. And they'll decide if they like that or they'll want someone who's much more partisan than I am.
So, you know, this was obviously a day or two before he announced, before DeMaio announced. And DeMaio's trying to characterize Peters as partisan. And Peters is trying to characterize DeMaio as partisan. And DeMaio's, you know, so I just think it's funny how he's saying that you can't even file to run, and he's already announcing so he can raise money.
But it's interesting, if you listen to his commentary just then, it's interesting. He's like, wants to keep his all about business, you know, keep it above the other things that are really going, that he may think he can try and avoid them. He will not be able to avoid them. And I think it's great if he can manage to really get a platform for himself and really get ready to confront those issues. Well, no, we'll see what happens. But at least it's going to, you know, he's not going to be able to sidestep it, though.
There he can't do that at all. I asked him a little bit later who his sort of his best Republican
I can only speak for myself.
BFF is here. And
that's different.
Let me see if I can find
next
that.
Next year, if I do my job, voters will say, yeah.
You know, and he's depending upon a lot of people, I think, paying attention.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can get.
He wants to get the vibe and see, you know.
He's really hoping people are going to pay attention in a way that he wants them to pay attention.
Yeah.
Admittedly, you know, this event that he was at, he wants them to look at the totality of his record and all this thing. I don't know how much that resonates with voters, because they really tend to only look at, you know, what they need immediately.
Yeah.
Nope. Someday I'll figure this out. But today, no.
That's okay.
So anyhow, I think that's probably the most fun thing to happen locally right now. You know, it was interesting, too, you know, to see some of the feedback that we're getting on this. And a lot of the feedback from people has been very positive. But at the same time, you know, it's interesting how low-key San Diegans are about politics.
Well, yeah, you know, but when we look at DeMaio, though, in this particular instance, he was, you know, he's a runner-up to the position of mayor, so he had a good.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have won if somebody else was running. Yeah. He wouldn't have even been close.
Yeah, true.
You know, he wouldn't have been close at all if Fletcher was running. It would have been a landslide for Fletcher, and DeMaio would have been a distant third. He was sort of like He's the Republican Republicans don't like.
Yeah.
Just like Filner's the Democrat the Democrats really don't like.
Yeah.
You know? They like, yeah, he's a Democrat, but they don't like him. He's abrasive, he's aggressive.
Yeah.
You know? And those aren't things that I think San Diegans jive well.
He would do well. I mean, it's interesting to note, if you took Filner and put him in Philadelphia, you know, sort of Jersey somewhere, he'd, you know, where irascible sort of tones can be sort of, you know, or sort of expected. I think you're right in some ways. I think it's tough, and I think that's what's going to be interesting about, you know, 2016. If Fletcher Nathan decides to run for mayor, it could be an interesting race because he's now running as a Democrat, as we know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, Filner's so entrenched in that party.
Yeah.
Can Fletcher wouldn't be able to get the
the nomination. That's the other thing. Fletcher wouldn't be able to get the nod from the Democratic Party. He could run as a Democrat, but whether or not he'd get party money, you know, well, in the same way that Filner can, because Filner's, he knows how to work that system very well.
He does, but the interesting thing about this is, I mean, a lot of what the demographic that's changed in San Diego that's taken it from being a very strong GOP centrist area or region to a more moderate, in fact, I would say right now it's even tipping toward the Democrat side, is the fact that the young people, I think, are pushing that agenda. And if, you know, I don't know, who knows if Filner decides he wants to run another term or not, but I think the age thing catches up with you a little bit, I think.
He's at what? He's almost 70. He's in his 70s,
he's
right?
He's in his 70s, yeah.
You know. He wouldn't know it. you really wouldn't know it. I mean, he's as aggressive today as you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah, he's still feisty. I give him credit. I mean, he's a feisty, tough guy. I give him credit, you know. But again, how that resonates with it, even the new Democrats.
Yeah,
they're new Democrats, and could change the whole...
What does that even mean? People say neoconservative and neoliberal, but what does that even mean?
Well, you know, I mean...
There's like a big kind of international philosophy behind those things, but I don't understand even really what that means.
Well, I think in a more local level, and I'll simplify this, I think the more localized view of this is simply that, you know, the traditional, I mean, I've always used the term, like, people don't like, you know, this is not the 1970s Democrat or Republicans, you know, where, you know, it was strictly issues like if you were Republican, it was fiscal responsibility, economics, or the culture of the day. It really wasn't about the religious overtones that you see so strongly that have taken over, and even, you know, the sort of libertarian overtones that have taken over the Republican Party in some ways, or at least have factionalized the Republican Party. Yeah. And then the Democrats, where you had these little sort of like strong protesters, you know, real anti-war, you know, it was really, high taxes and, you know, things like that, and, you know, big government. I think the Democrats are evolving to, I mean, everybody's becoming shades of gray. You know, it's not black and white anymore. It's now that they want, you know, the Democrats are a little more, leaning more to the middle, which is so funny when they hear them talk about liberals. Liberals today are not liberals of, you know, the 1970s or even the 1980s. Those are the Green Party now. You know, to be honest with you. So the ideas of social issues, yes, the Democrats are still Democrats, but even then they're not as predisposed to stand up for them as strongly as they did at one point in time when I was growing up. They're just not the same. It's not the same party, and it's evolving. And some people would say for the better because it's less contentious, but even though they try to politicize the Democrats as being far on the far fringe, they really are not. The Democrats today are a very moderate centrist party in many ways, much more than people give them credit for. I think they've come much more to the middle than the left gives them credit for, to be honest with you.
Since we don't have a Republican here to refute that, because Republicans would totally disagree with you on that.
Okay.
Republicans are constantly trying to characterize the Democratic Party as, like, communist. I mean, they still use the term communist, which is
ludicrous.
It's lazy. It's really lazy politics, in my opinion. It's like, you can make a better argument than fucking communist. That's stupid.
Explain that.
They try to make that point that Democratic Party is full of extremists and they're not, and, you know.
Yeah, but that's just the boogeyman's tactic, you know. It's trying to scare people to think people are doing something they really aren't doing. Look at the presidents, the last Democratic presidents we've had, very moderate. Their economic policies were centered sleeping slightly to the right.
I mean,
and then people sit back and go, well, these people are, you know, card-carrying liberals and, you know, want to see our socialists and all this other craziness. And it's sort of silly. It's like, but again, they count on Americans not understanding what most of this stuff is. So therefore, they just respond to the rhetoric and not to the actual reality.
Education matters in this case.
Sometimes it does. If you do your homework, I mean, you know, I spent 20 plus years, you know, in this field, you know, I mean, actually, well, I won't even go how long, but long enough it's just, you know, it's sort of, you know, I know the game and I know how politics is played and I know how they have to sell it.
So what was it like meeting George Washington? Right?
George was about an inch taller than I am. You know, I'm 6'3", he's 6'4". That's pretty tall for the 1700s, you know. Boy, the guy had a great pitching arm, I tell you.
Yeah. So here, I've got some of the president, his weekly address here, and his big push, of course, now is the economy. It seems like he's trying to step away from his bigger international issues.
Well, he also talked about student loan stuff, too.
Student loan, I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, huge deal.
Let's see if I can get
their homes and the sense of security they've worked so hard to build. But thanks to the grit and determination of the American people, our businesses have now created nearly 7 million new jobs over the past 30 years.
I always wonder about that stat. How do you even determine what that means?
Once again, the heartbeat.
You know, you say, oh, we've created 7 million jobs. That's like saying unemployment is down. You know, I mean,
within the next few months,
Americans buying cars, that could be just a thing that happens as the result of the way the year works. People buy more cars in the spring and summer than they do in the winter. It's just a cycle. So he's trying to take credit for that. I think that's a little much.
We got more jobs in McDonald's. Hey.
And a housing market that was in tatters is showing new signs of real strength.
Of course, this housing market thing, I don't know much about either. I think a lot of that's overinflated as a result of foreign investment. You know,
that's a huge part of it, but it's also...
But I could be speaking from a local perspective because the average price of a house in San Diego is $400,000.
Yeah, this week, you can't even live in a ghetto in San Diego. We call it ghetto. Under about 350,
modify their mortgages.
Yeah, and he's still talking about mortgage modification. I mean, that tells me that there's still big problems with banking.
Let's face it, part of the problem here is we deal with the reality of our economy that's so driven by the property that we have killed our economy because people have to spend so much of their income on their housing that people can't buy and other things.
You can't do anything. Just can't. Yeah, I mean, it's nuts how much even just rent costs. And I don't think that Americans are buying homes the way that investors are buying homes.
Yeah,
I think it's a lot of foreign money.
Oh, absolutely. Well, here's the other thing. People think, before when credit was easy to get, the illusion certainly...
You know, I wish I had known that because I would have gotten a shitload of credit. I didn't even know that. I thought you had to have a job and an income, and I thought all of those things mattered. You know?
No, not at all. But the funny thing about it was that would give... So if you got caught up paying a larger portion of your income towards your housing requirements, then you had credit to be able to go and pick up and buy the other stuff that made you feel like you were part of the normal middle class.
Yeah.
And people never realize how poor they are in terms of real money until they stop. If somebody took your credit cards away, what would your lifestyle look like? You know. And now people are finding out because credit's tougher to get now than in a long, long time. So then now people are beginning to see just how poor they really are.
And now he's talking about how, the economy is growing, but we need to keep growing. That's the things are okay, but we need to keep going kind of speech. And of course, he's trying to blame the right for being partisan and all of that kind of.
Congress should pass a law giving every responsible homeowner the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgage by refinancing at historically low interest rates. Congress should put more Americans to work rebuilding our crumbling roads and bridges, like the one that collapsed last week in Washington.
And that's where the right would have a problem with them, because they're going to see that as
would fall faster,
you know, like WPA-style projects, infrastructure, that's public employment.
And, which would be great because we need it. Borders,
hold isn't that essentially what the pyramids were?
Exactly.
The public works projects.
Well, you put them together, it helps drive the economy, you get new jobs, families, you know, and people paying taxes. Why would you not do that?
Engineers,
either pay now or you pay later. Do you want
to run welfare or taking up, taking
money that we don't have, or would you rather have them building roads and bridges and paying taxes? Hello?
Because we've got more good jobs to
create. There's no rocket science to it. It's just they make
more
doors of opportunity to open for anyone who's willing to work hard enough to walk.
It's getting better, and we just need to keep going.
I'm as confident as I've ever been.
Well, it'll be after our lifetime.
I mean, that's the big problem is that this stuff isn't about things being better now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the problem, you know, is that people want stuff to be better now.
Well, they want instant gratification, but let's face it, it's not really instant.
Well, it's not really even instant gratification. Yeah. I think people want to be able to pay their rent now. And
exactly.
They want to be able to send their kids to college and that kind of shit.
I agree.
Looking to just, you know, I don't think it's like a delusion. I don't think it's like they want this imaginary, you know, middle class lifestyle. I think people want basic needs met.
Yeah, particularly now. Let's face it. You know, the reality of what the middle class is today has changed drastically. And I actually, I would, I will take, not, I won't say I disagree, but let me just say it this way. I think people do want a middle-class lifestyle. I think people look at a nice little, like we're here in Kensington, you look at a nice little, these are nice little homes. They're probably 1,500 to maybe 1,200, 1,500 square foot homes.
Yeah.
That are now, what, probably about $700,000 or $800,000.
Yeah, almost a million, pushing $1 million.
Pushing $1 million that normally even 25 years ago, you could have bought for like $50,000 to $75,000.
Who the fuck is buying these homes? Because nobody's making more money.
No, not in San Diego, that's for sure.
You know, nobody. That's where I want to know is where this money's coming from. Yeah. Because nobody's making more money. Yeah. I know in TV news, overall wages have not gone up since the 90s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And that's just in general, in news in general. Things have actually gone down. And
it's
I know
kind of scary.
It's frightening. Well, you know, it's frightening, especially when you look at how fucking awful most news products are.
Yeah.
They're just poorly done.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
just bad. You know, big secret out there for the sort of people who watch news is that all TV news stations get their news from exactly the same place.
Yeah.
And we're just marketing it differently because it's not about the content, it's about the surface.
Exactly.
And if you're an astute news watcher, you know this. And I think people do recognize that.
Yeah.
But they don't see it as exactly the same story. They see it as, I'm just bored now. And so they decide to consume news from other areas like BBC. And yeah. so there's this huge disconnect because there's a hunger for information and news sort of about the world people live in, but there's yeah. no knowledge about their local
exactly
region, except through kind of these pundits and stuff, because the newspaper is crap now.
Yeah.
It's just a piece of shit. It's just a poorly done newspaper. They fired all their reporters. Yeah. You know, I mean, so nobody's got any local news.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, Voice of San Diego does great political work, and they do good work along those lines, but sometimes they're kind of... They're almost like a specialty product, you know? So you already have to be interested in news to know that they even exist.
Well, that's the thing. Most people don't even know that these organizations exist that try very hard to
So how can
educate.
You have local government? How can you have... And then that kind of expands to these local federal offices yeah. like yeah. Congress. And how do you even... How does that even happen?
Well, it's almost like you wish that they might as well put a crown on the guy or the woman's head and call him a king or queen, right? And call it a day, because if you're not, yeah. like, you know, the hard truth, in fact, they've been having some interesting news on the radio. They've had some interesting commentary about democracy, they were saying that, you know, democracy is based on your participation, which I've always said in my classes, you know, if you don't participate in it, it's not a democracy.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, what we should do is, you know, is take it away from you for a little while and see how you like it without that. Just like I used to use the term socialism when I talk about socialism in class, and I'd say, you don't like socialism, but there's a lot of it in the country. I said, and if we took it away from you for 6 months, most of you would come running back yeah. crying for, please let me have the things that I get that you take for granted that are part of, that are socialism.
Well, public schools.
Thank
were,
you.
were a huge socialist thing.
Exactly.
That, that there was paying? A huge fight against public schools when they were trying to institute them.
Oh, yeah. Well, imagine what you'd be paying for education if they didn't have...
A police force.
Police force,
a
fire.
A police force. There, that show on the BBC Copper is about one of the first publicly paid police forces in New York City. Before then, it was all private Pinkertons.
Yep.
It was all privately run security.
Yep.
And you had to pay into a fund so that you could put a little badge outside your house.
Yep.
And a
if,
little
you,
bit
didn't
down. If you didn't, your house would burn down because yep. the firemen weren't publicly paid,
yep.
or the police simply wouldn't respond because they weren't publicly paid.
Yeah.
So,
which is why we have a public administration system. Which
yeah.
Because I know I teach in public administration as well, and that's one of the values that people don't realize is that the infrastructure of the country is built on a social model that's built around the ideas of trying to protect the public. Guess what? That's socialism. You may not like it. You may not like the word, which didn't do anything to anybody. But the truth of the matter is, this is what you see, and it's, you know, for all its foibles and all its difficulty and its controversies, you know, we couldn't live without it.
Yeah.
FDR's New Deal program was socialism. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty. Yeah. It was pretty blatantly socialism.
Yeah.
His big push, I think, one of the things he wanted to push through too was nationalized healthcare.
Yeah.
That he never got pushed through, but he really wanted to.
Yeah.
And with Obamacare coming up, everybody's wondering how that's going to work out because it's such a complicated system. Now you've got 50 states each. Some maybe opted in for the Medicare money, some maybe didn't.
Yeah.
And what's that going to mean for their healthcare system, and what are these exchanges going to look like, and how is all this going to happen? What are employers going to do? And it seems like, you know, one big thing has been like, one big kind of left conspiracy theory has been like, well, been that the right is going to make this process so unbelievably complicated and convoluted that nobody will want it. Well, I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see once how everybody reacts once everybody has healthcare. People always want to criticize countries without it, but I got to tell you, you know, I've been in those countries and I've been in those health systems, and they are as good as, or if not better than, anything we've got going on here.
Yeah.
And that's just from my perspective, living in those countries and living in under those systems. From my perspective, that's just facts.
Well, the thing about it is, let's face it, if you know. The idea that if you were sick and you didn't have health care, you're still going to go and get help. And no hospital is going to turn you away. So guess what? We're still paying for it.
It just costs a shit ton more money.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea, if you nationalize.
Well, that's why the United States spends, at least according to the World Bank, and a lot of people, I suppose, could say the World Bank doesn't know what they're doing when it comes to money. But I think that they tend to have some pretty smart people over there.
Absolutely.
You know, according to the World Bank, we spend 17% of our GDP on healthcare.
Yeah.
And Germany spends about 10.
Yeah.
The UK spends about 11. You know, all these countries with these massive socialist systems within the EU that, you know, people are saying, oh, it's falling apart and it's because of socialized medicine. And that's the big argument they're trying to make right now. The economy in Europe is the result of their medical system, which is complete bullshit.
Yeah, of course. With a capital B.
With a capital, yeah. The GDP on healthcare, we spend a lot more money on it. So the truth is unless you're willing to let people die in the streets, the fiscally conservative position is a nationalized system.
Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah.
When you look at the facts objectively, unless you're willing to let people die in the streets, and a lot of people, honestly, I don't have a problem with that at all.
I think they would. They just say, just get them up in the street sweeper and keep going.
Yeah. They wouldn't have a problem with
that. But in an economic sense, you would have to, there is a strong argument to say that it makes sense even for those in the GOP who are, and on the Democratic side who are, you know, strong on the economy, it makes really solid.
Now, why wouldn't they make that argument? I have yet to hear that argument made in an aggressive public manner.
I know. If they broke it down just in that vein, they could rationalize and come up with a plan. There's no way they could refute a plan based on, if they looked at real numbers like that and the cost, there's no way they could get around the justification from an economic perspective of doing that. I don't see it, unless there's something I'm missing. I haven't seen it, but no one's making that argument. You know,
that's what I wonder. Do you think that if they make that argument, I mean, fiscal conservatives can't make that argument because that's not really what they're about.
No,
they're about something different. But I wonder if they just would be taken seriously. I mean, do people, they would just blow them off, or kind of try and frame the World Bank or other institutions that gather this information as, you know, big UN conspiracies?
Well, that's why I think you should have. You know what? Get a big piece of paper, do economics for dummies, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful sense. I mean simply from just like the books that are out there
for people like me.
For people like you and me. No, but to be able to sit back.
Well,
and
no, I mean look. The reason you know what you know, because you've been educated in that. And a lot of times I think that taking academics and people, you know, that knowledge and then being able to communicate that to the masses is a challenge.
Yeah,
because there's a set of vocabulary that you can't use because normal people don't use those terms.
Yeah.
They don't understand. I mean, normal people just don't understand a lot of the broader, they don't understand macro, micro. They don't understand these things.
Yeah, but it could be
explained.
Absolutely. And the best teachers are not the ones that sort of over-intellectualize everything.
Yeah.
The best teachers are those that can take complex ideas and simplify them. That's why you can teach little kids algebra.
Yeah.
You can teach little kids, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, literally teach them algebra because it's taught in such a way that they can grasp the concepts. If a 5-year-old can grasp it, I'm hoping that a person who has a few more years along the line could probably grasp basic concepts as well.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the struggle is. It's not about over-intellectualizing. It's about being able to really utilize our minds to be able to get around and show the public exactly what the what the dollar amounts are, and let's stop politicizing it. Let's make it so that whether matter what side of the aisle you're on, you get, here's the real picture, so people can make real decisions. You know?
Yeah. So this week also, Turkey has been going nuts. I'm playing a little bit of the White House press briefing in the background here. And I'm trying to get to a point to where they started to talk about Turkey and Syria. They made a few comments on it. So if you hear that in the background, that's what's going on here. But so you of course, being an expert in the Middle East, we're talking about this. Now, is this just like students revolting, or what? Who is this, and what's going on? I thought Turkey was the next EU member, and I thought everything was relatively okay, excluding, of course, the Kurdish issue.
Well, I think Turkey, this is, it's complicated. Turkey's one of those places, because if you ask people in the Middle East, Turkey's not really a Middle East nation.
Yeah. Right? It's the elbow of the world, right?
It is
that point between Europe and the Middle East,
exactly.
And even
in
Eurasia.
In Asia, that's where they, in fact,
I mean, it's...
And so understanding the culture dynamics, I think...
I've always thought of Turkey like, what was that show? Any kind of show about... Oh, God, what was that TV show with Lucy Lawless?
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about,
yeah.
Where she ran around with I think she played a lesbian in it.
Yeah.
It was... God, I can't remember the name of it now. Xena, Warrior Princess.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, she was in a world where there was this European, Asian, there was this huge mix of cultures and worlds, and I've always thought of Turkey, for some reason, whenever I talk about it, even though I know that's not the reality of Turkey, but that's kind of the myth, right, of Turkey, that it's this big mix and collision of worlds. And so it's not this monolithic culture. I think that's really important for people to kind of...
Well, it's not. The history in the region is such that if people understood the sort of like long history of the, going dating back to the Ottomans and even before the Ottomans, to the Timurids and to the Umayyads who were there, it's a much more complicated area than looking at this in the terms of like the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Is it an Arab Spring from the aspect of Islam? You could argue that for those who are Muslims that reside in the country, absolutely, you can make that argument. The people are looking for political change. You know, Turkey is a much more educated society than some of the other countries in the Middle East. Erdogan's been around for a long time. That people are concerned about his becoming—he's becoming the Putin of Turkey. You know, he's been there for a decade, more than a decade now, and people are worried about him not disappearing, and he's becoming more authoritarian, and people aren't happy with that, and so they're rising up in protest, and there's been some reprisal, and so
what do they want?
They want to see democratic change. They want to see new leadership.
What does a new leader look like to them?
Well, that's the problem that we have in these situations, right?
Yeah.
Depends on who you ask. that's the problem, because if you ask the Islamic fundamentalists, you're going to get one answer. You ask the Islamic liberals, they're going to get another answer.
Yeah.
You ask the secular. The secularist, then you're going to get another whole answer as well. So it's sort of interesting to note how, and this is the struggle Turkey has, right, is how do you get one leader that's going to satisfy all those different types of wants and change?
Mm-hmm.
And for a certain level, I understand Erdogan's problem here. Part of it is, it's a legitimate problem, is who's going to come to power after him?
Yeah.
Do you get someone
that's what everyone's afraid of, right?
Exactly. Because let's face it.
What does it turn into?
Yeah, because it becomes much more leaning toward an Islamic theocracy that is not pro-West or looking to the West. And what does that look like? So, we have a great concern about this, even though, I think it's going to stabilize a lot less crazy than some of the other parts, other Arab Springs. I think it's going to be a little less contentious than that. It's a much more...
There's been all this great YouTube video coming out of the protests in their parks or squares that, yeah. that kind of like seem to happen in those older cities. You've yeah. got these kind of squares that yeah. just kind of naturally exist.
Yeah, yeah. They're like the piazzas.
The piazzas. Plazas. They just yeah. exist yeah. everywhere. You yeah. live in an apartment, there's a square right there.
Yeah.
It's not like they built a park like they did here. It doesn't exist the same way.
Yeah. And this one in Turkey is in Taksim Square, and it's yeah. and that's where the first big protest takes place. And you know, is it... I don't think you'll have the same sort of repercussions you had in like Egypt and other places because I think it's a little less contentious than that. There are those who you know certainly are more radicalized, and you always have those in, you know that are you know predisposed to civil disobedience and civil violence. But I also think that a large part of the population is, you know, or wants to have peaceful protests and demonstrate. And I think that's where it's going to probably land more directly.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to turn into this huge violent, you know, thing like in Syria or in Libya and other places. I don't see that happening.
No.
Speaking of Syria.
Yeah, I know. Huh? I know. Huh? That whole area. Ooh. I mean, you could drive. You drive to Turkey. They have a border.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, I had a friend, and she was along in the Turkish side of the Syrian border there for a few months trying to cover that. And just on the other side was this big refugee camp, but still technically in Syria.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, you kind of look at that thing and you just kind of go, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, now what? Europe is going to start selling guns. To start giving guns or selling guns or whatever it is they're doing to the Syrian rebels. Russians and Chinese are giving arms to the Assad regime. Yeah. So now is this a proxy war as part of this, like, you know, we were talking earlier and you called it the new cold?
Yeah,
the new cold war,
yeah. It's kind of like, it's interesting, man. I think this particular instance shows... Will really sort of display on a certain level, maybe a small level, this new. I mean, is there this sort of this question? This new sort of Russia, China.
Is there a new Eastern Bloc?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the old Eastern Bloc, and I don't want to create that image for you because it's not that. It's much less violent and contentious that way. It's a bloc driven by the economics of it all, but it's also. Russia and China have been doing a lot of business together for a while, and again, they don't really care about the infrastructure
of the countries. So is this a plutocratic?
Yeah.
What oligarchy versus a plutocratic republic kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly what it appears.
And are we more concerned about business interests and less about human rights and those bigger, more, you know, loftier notions that we kind of really
well,
like
well,
to think.
Well, let's face it, we've sexied it up a little bit more, too. Instead of, you know, wearing a military uniform, these guys wear nice Hugo Boss suits, and, you know, that doesn't mean that they just changed how they're applying the tactic.
The people in charge and managing these things, not like the rebels in the Syria.
Exactly.
I mean, the people managing these Russia now are... You know, they're not wearing the old communist uniform.
Yeah, no, they're not. It's much more.
We've been that way. The United States has been this kind of merchant, run system for since its inception.
Absolutely.
That was really why business is what drove this country in a lot of ways, a lot more than I think government.
Yeah,
and I think that's a legitimate thing to say, and that's a legitimate, Republican and a legitimate conservative perspective is that. It was always a free merchant class.
Well, yeah, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the people who built the nation certainly in the 19th century, and late 18th century are those who all the way up through the Industrial Revolution, you know, and into the early 20th century, those people are the ones who basically ran and controlled government. You know, I mean,
but how is that reinterpreted?
Well,
in a Russian or Chinese context, because that's kind of what has happened, right? You've got these plutocratic systems now.
Yeah.
But what does that mean in those contexts?
Well, for us, I think the difference is that, you know, the United States still has some basis of its foundation in religion. You know, there's always been this sort of philosophical and psychological response to religion and morality that had been so pervasive in our upbringing, even though I would argue those that were in power maybe had didn't worry about it quite as much. But it's always been part of our of the psychology and ethos of our culture. And now that wasn't the case in China and Russia so much. And even though Russia has the Orthodox Church, during the communist period, it was certainly put down. You were not allowed to, you couldn't even practice religion in the Soviet Union during that time for the most part.
Yeah.
So there really is the psychology of morality and those types of things isn't quite as important in some of those countries as it is here. So consequently, it really changes the action. Like here, we always try and say, should we do it? Because even though what we tell the people here in the United States, we go, well, we won't do that because we know it hurts the people. We go to the moral imperative. Yeah. Over there, they're like, excuse me, fuck the moral imperative. The reality is, we care about the money. We care about, they don't care about human rights. It's a secondary notion to
economics. China is an important country economically, not because of their mass, because of their numbers.
Yeah.
Really. It's because, is it a perspective like on it, kind of like we see billion plus potential consumers?
Absolutely.
That's why we see them as powerful.
Oh, absolutely.
Not because that billion plus potential consumers are all employed and all spending money, but because they potentially could.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that plus you have the working force too.
The labor force, of course.
You have a cheap labor
force,
and you've got new consumers, and all you have to do, you don't have to have as many people.
They're cheap, and reality is they're disposable.
Absolutely.
And the only reason that Foxconn put up those suicide nets was because of attention brought to people jumping out of the windows there, not because they thought, oh, shit, people are killing themselves.
Yeah.
So, people are the cheapest commodity in China. The reason you move your labor overseas isn't because you want to pay people less.
Yeah.
I mean, people are cheap here, but it's also because dealing with the government there can be made more smooth through just paying them.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you actually have to make change because it's enforced by laws.
Well, just like you look at the Chinese economy, I mean, they just cook the books. Fix their economy, their economy looks good because they cook the books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Russia, let's face it, Russia, the economy.
Well, it's the same thing there, right?
It's corruption.
You look at those, what's the guy who owns is it the LA, the big Russian oligarch that owns, that guy basically walked into oil wealth and it was given to him. And, as long as he continues to play ball with the powers that be.
Yeah.
But he's an oligarch, and he's part of that plutocratic system.
Exactly.
And he's as much a part of it. And that's what amazes me is then this guy comes to the United States and is buying up sports teams and doing all this shit. And you're like, this guy's a fucking dangerous human being.
Yeah.
I mean, not like rich guy like he's like kills millions of people to get his oil kind of thing. So he's part of the system that is funding the Assad regime.
Yeah.
And he owns a basketball team in L.A.
Yeah. But that's the thing. People don't realize.
I can't remember his name. But
that's funny. People don't realize just
that's
how.
That's kind of fucked up.
Well, yeah. Well, people don't realize that. So most people don't even know that, And it's the sad part is because of that, it really changes. It really leaves us sort of vulnerable because there are things that at least publicly in the United States, we've always done our dirt too.
Well, of course.
But we've always hidden it, and you create an image for the population that everything is good and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But then behind closed doors, you go to do what you have to do to secure your own economic viability. That would be the justification for what we did in Latin America, Central America, and all over the world, right? But now we have competition for those same markets that we didn't have before.
Yeah.
And they're willing to do things that, at least publicly, that we really can't really get away with anymore because of the limelight of, now they're really
You can't do what Nabisco did in the 70s in Africa these days.
No.
That would kill Nabisco as a corporation.
Exactly.
I mean, Africans could sue them.
Exactly.
Now, and they could be held liable for their actions.
Oh, it's absolutely. Actually, I mean, so now it becomes a situation in the United States where how do we go about trying to compete with a new bloc of Russia-China against the United States?
Well, why does it always have to be us competing with capitalisms that do this capitalism kind of through oppression?
Yeah.
When, because that's not the American ideal of capitalism.
No.
Right? That's not how I see it. That's not how I would want to see it.
Yeah.
It's not something you create and – But then again, you know, our economy for the early part of the nation was you know, capitalism through oppression.
Yeah.
It was that. That's what the argument was for slavery.
Yeah.
It was essentially an oppressive
Absolutely.
Capitalism.
Slavery
why is it that we can't get past that even today?
Well, I think we struggle with the real hard concerns of capitalism. I think we really struggle with that. I think we've always struggled with it, at least on some level. For those who understand what capitalism really is, we've had a hard time confronting the difficult parts of capitalism, the parts mm-hmm. that Karl Marx spoke about. If people don't like Karl Marx, and you don't have to be a Marxist to look at his commentary on capitalism, which really is an economic issue, not dealing with this term of capitalism in its vein. But the truth is, some of the concerns, legitimate concerns that Marx had about the dangers of capitalism, have played out throughout the last century. You know, and it's a struggle. It's a struggle for, you know, economic viability. In fact, Marx said, keep the good stuff of capitalism, but stop the, you know, the exploitation of the workers and that kind of stuff. And ultimately, what you see play out in some way, shape, or form are the realities of some of what Marx and some other writers of that time, the concerns they had about some of these issues of economics and the working class and the wealthy. And this is the struggle we still have. Everybody has the illusion of wanting to be wealthy, or that they are wealthy, and they don't really confront the fact of how poor they really are. You know?
Well, on that, I'm going to take my illusion of wealth.
The illusion of wealth. We'll get back.
I have the internet. I have a computer. I have a big TV. I'm a wealthy man.
You are a wealthy
man. It's true.
You bought it all on credit, right?
But by comparison, no. I fucking hate credit. I have a credit card just because you have to establish credit, and
yeah.
I've used it to pay for certain things, and it's just like, I fucking hate using credit. But in order to really exist in society today, you kind of have to be a part of that world.
Yeah,
I fucking hate being a part of it.
Yeah, but again, that's because we got ourselves tether ourselves to things like credit, to a house, and then we let that become the things that drive our economy. And then all of a sudden, when things go bad, our economy goes to crap because, people can't afford anything anymore. And they can't afford credit, and they can't afford a house, and then they become a problem for the economy because they have to start using the government for assistance, and so it becomes this vicious cycle.
Yeah,
you know, it's a cycle of like the what's the little animal that runs in a little
hamster?
The hamster running in the cage that just keeps running and keeps running, right?
Yeah, or I like the more esoteric metaphor of Saturn devouring his children.
That's a good analogy.
That's what it is, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean,
yep.
You know, you're eating your own kids.
But the sad part,
with credit.
Oh, yeah, but the sad part, I think, the people at the top really sometimes don't really understand is how much they really need the people. They have to get the people in the middle and lower class to buy into their BS. But the sad part about it is I don't think they realize how much they really need. Like, for example, if your house note could be cut in half, so you could then go and consume more goods or be able to buy things.
Yeah, yeah.
You're generating new jobs for people and new things to generate and move the economy.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen with me because, as the guy says in New York, rent is just too damn high.
I know.
It is. San Diego should have its own. I think we should do minimum wages regionally based on the economy.
That's what they
regionally.
Do. That's what they do up in NorCal.
Yeah,
you know,
it should be
Silicon
regional
Valley.
Because well they have to because nobody, I mean,
McDonald's workers in Silicon Valley. Okay.
Yeah, but you know you're going to work at McDonald's there and you're still barely scraping by.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's not like just because you happen to be working at McDonald's and making $45,000 a year doesn't mean you're making you can't scrape by in San Diego on $45,000 a year. Yeah. It's,
you can make $100,000 a year here, and be very, very average.
Yeah.
And after taxes, $100,000 doesn't look like about 50. And when you pay rent, pay car note, and just a basic living.
You're living hand to mouth, and most people are. So.
Yep. Yep.
So, on that happy note, we're almost at an hour here. Next month we'll have to get more people. I'm working on getting some other people. I like that we were able to play that Peterson soundbite.
Yeah, we'll get some more people in. So
I'm
going to
get
some
people are listening. We'll get, you know, the Democrats are more willing to work with you than the Republicans. But I'll work on that.
I don't know why, though. You know,
I don't know why, but they seem to be more interested in, but it's your perspective, but...
But you know what, though? But it's really, I mean, we're not about... This
I bet we could get young Republicans to come in, because those guys will do anything. They'll do anything. It's not that they'll do anything. It's that they're more open-minded. Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah.
But
that guy's got long hair, too, so he's like a hippie Republican anyhow, yeah. Right? I wonder how many people confuse him for the Democrats.
But you know what? The young Republicans, I think, are also... I mean, they're interested in having a dialogue, and it's not, yeah. It doesn't become just...
Well, the young Republicans are those big tenters, right? Yeah. Isn't that what DeMaio's hoping for?
Yeah. But the part of that I think is really key is that, I mean, even as we sit here today, and somebody would say, well, you must be a card-carrying liberal or a Democrat or whatever. I'm like, you know, I'm a political agnostic. I really am. I don't really, I really don't care so much about which side, you know, I don't like, I really prefer not being categorized. I don't like people to say, well, you must be this or that. No, I'm a person who has a free mind to think what I want to think, and I will make my decisions about individuals based on their qualification and how they resonate with my commentary about social issues or about the economy. That has nothing to do with whether I'm a liberal. I mean, people who would assert one thing would be surprised to find where I really stand on these issues.
Yeah.
So I, you know,
there you
those
go.
Who try and categorize you, all their glitters ain't gold.
Rick Epps, the new Republican.